seriously popular.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
The former nurse, Lucy Letby, has been found guilty
of murdering 7 babies and attempting to kill 6 others
at the Countess of Chester Hospital.
Between June 2015 and June 2016,
babies who seemed to be doing reasonably well would suddenly collapse. Lucy Letby was the common factor.
The verdicts make the 33-year-old
Britain's most prolific baby killer.
Lucy Letby, I sentence you to imprisonment for life.
This was a podcast about one of the most anticipated criminal trials for years. It's now a podcast about one of the worst serial killers in modern times. At 12:52 p.m. on Friday, August the 18th, 2023, we brought you the news that a neonatal nurse was guilty of killing babies in her care.
After a trial lasting for over 10 months and more than 110 hours of painstaking deliberation, the jury decided that Lucy Letby murdered 7 babies at the Countess of Chester Hospital and she tried to kill 6 more.
She was cleared of 2 further charges of attempted murder and the jury could not reach verdicts on 6 further allegations.
I'm Liz Hull, Northern correspondent for The Mail. I've been in court throughout and have reported on the case as it developed.
And I'm Caroline Cheatham, a broadcast journalist. Every week we've examined what's happened and brought you the details behind the headlines.
This is the trial of Lucy Letby.
So Liz, today's episode is about the people who we met during this trial because they were sitting in Court 8. And as we know, Court 8 was next to Court 7 where the main trial was happening. And it was basically the public gallery.
Yeah.
We became really conscious, didn't we, during the trial of a few people who were there consistently.
Yeah, so Court 7 essentially was full as soon as the families, Lucy Letby's family, the journalists, the police officers, there was no space for the public in the public gallery in Court 8. So what the court management team did at Manchester Crown Court was facilitate Court 8 next door to be free for members of the public. And we've talked about this before, haven't we, on the podcast, about justice being seen to be done and how it's important that anyone that feels that they want to go and watch a court case or observe a court case should be allowed to go in. It's a fundamental cornerstone of British justice that the public should be allowed into
open.
The court.
It's open justice.
Yeah. And it became clear to me after a few months probably in that the same people were coming every day or every other day or a couple of times a week to watch what was going on. And we all became quite friendly with them. Obviously, we'd see them in the corridor quite a lot. We got talking to them and we were fascinated really about why they felt it important to come and why they were so invested in it.
Well, one of the reasons they felt it important to come and were so invested was because they were listening to the podcast.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of them started reading about the trial in the press and then got to know about our podcast and were following it and thought, probably because we had some guests on, obviously, that talked about the importance of the public being allowed to go into court. And some of them, I know for definite, decided, well, if we're allowed to go, I'm gonna go along and have a look.
Yeah, they felt this was important.
Yeah.
What's really interesting about this, and it was such an amazing conversation with four of them, wasn't it? So we've got a criminology student, a lady who runs a small business from home. We've got two retired nurses. They started out with a really open mind, and certainly one of them, Mary, desperately wanted it not to be true.
Yeah, she wanted Lucy Letby to be innocent, really, because she didn't want her profession to be tarnished or, you know, damaged by the fact that a nurse could possibly have done these things. And talking to them was fascinating. None of them knew each other before they started coming to court, but became good friends over the 10 months of the trial. They'll be lifelong friends, probably, with those four.
I completely agree. They were really kind. They don't live anywhere near Manchester, actually. And they travelled over to the studio here and chatted to us for an afternoon.
Welcome to episode 62, The Court Watchers.
So we've got Jane, we've got Mary, we've got Ollie, and we've got Jules with us.
Ollie, tell me what made you want to follow the trial.
I'm a former criminology student, so that gives some insight, I suppose, as to why I've been following the trial. I've always had that interest in sort of crime and the criminal justice system and the process that it follows. I first started coming to the trial in about late May, I think it was, during the cross-examination. I think my motivation for coming was I'd already formed certain opinions around the case from following it in the media and obviously via this podcast. And I just wanted to get a view for myself.
Jules, you've also been following it a lot. What made you come quite a distance from your home to the court every day?
I think originally I'd followed it in the media, the Chester Standard, and then found your podcast, which is gold, by the way. You had a court journalist on. He gave a really good report about, you know, how the criminal justice system should be opened. And if the public don't go, then maybe one day it might end up behind closed doors. And I just thought, well, I've never been to court. This case is intriguing me anyway. And then you sort of think, well, do you know what? I think I'm going to go and actually see for myself.
You basically got a bit hooked.
Oh, absolutely. You do become sort of invested.
Jane, you came from almost day one, didn't you?
Yes, that's right.
So
yes.
Just explain why you wanted to come.
Well, I'd read quite a lot in the press beforehand, and it was the medical facts, having been a nurse. I'm a retired nurse. It wasn't neonatal nursing I did. It was general nursing and paediatrics. Mm-hmm. But I was interested in the medical background to all of this. I had read that there was a rise in fatalities. And I was interested to find out what was behind it all. And then, of course, when I arrived at court that first week, I realised that there was more to this case than I think the defence tried to imply was bad practice or
failings at the hospital.
Failings, yes. But it was the medical details and the nursing practices, which for me, listening to all that, was actually like being back at work. I could literally sense the feeling what it would be like in that unit.
That they were baffled, you mean?
They were baffled.
Yeah.
How could these highly skilled doctors not make sense of what was happening? Mm. And yet, in the midst of it all was one name that ran through it all.
Yeah.
And that was when I thought, well, I need to put things on hold and I'm going to see this through.
When you came to court, Jane, a bit like Jules, you'd seen it reported in the papers, you knew somebody had been arrested, you knew they'd been charged, you knew the scale of it. Did you come with a really open mind at the beginning as a nurse, as a former nurse?
Yes, I did. There was something really in the back of my mind queried why there were no answers to some of these problems that were occurring.
And I wonder, as a nurse, obviously you watched these nurses from the Countess file in time and again. Some of them had to come back to give evidence. Can you imagine what that must have been like for them, having to come to court?
Oh, yes. And to actually speak about your fellow colleagues that you've worked alongside and try to just to be objective and say what you saw, what you didn't see, et cetera, et cetera. It was almost like seeing things unravel.
I'll bring Mary in if that's all right now, because Mary, you're also a tired nurse.
As Jane has already said, those babies were not ill as such. Mm. And so that was why the collapses were unexpected and inexplicable.
Did you come with an open mind to the trial? Did you come thinking there's no way someone of my profession could have done this?
I came with sympathy for the nurse, I must say. Mm-hmm. A professional sympathy. I didn't want it to be a nurse. And I clung to that idea for about 3 days. I arrived in time for the cross-examination. And that was what I really needed, because sitting at home and reading the press, I couldn't really get the detail. And that really started to clarify my thoughts. And it just became clearer and clearer in my mind that, unfortunately, a nurse seemed to have been the perpetrator. That was not what I wanted to find.
That's one of the things that struck me from certainly post the verdicts. Nobody wanted to believe what was happening was down to deliberate harm.
If people haven't heard that interview with Paul Hughes on the podcast, it's really moving, isn't it, Ollie?
Yeah. They have gone into it with an open mind to say, well, what has happened?
So, Jules, you were there for her defence. I know that that was kind of one of the most anticipated days, I think, for me in the trial. I think I probably thought she was guilty by then, but I thought if she's got any chance of kind of convincing the jury that she hadn't done it, she needed to make them like her.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What did you think about her?
I wasn't expecting someone so controlled. Maybe she's had so long to get used to the idea of the trial that then maybe it could be that. I just found her different on each day. So some days she was polite and plausible, but very self-assured the whole time. And other days she was petulant.
I felt quite confused by, at times, why she had decided to take the stand, because she gave... We had long stretches where she didn't give any information at all. She could have clarified things, but we started to get the repetitive, I don't recall, I have no memory of that, and so on.
She wanted to take control of the interview. She wanted to control the pace, and she would only reply when she was ready with the yes, the no, I don't know, I don't remember. And she almost looked at times that she was insulted that she was being asked these questions.
Mm. You know,
I thought it was interesting that at times when Ben Myers or Nick Johnson were taking her through the actual medical evidence, that she looked like she quite enjoyed kind of explaining.
The only thing that she faltered over was not having the knowledge when it came to the babies that were given the insulin. Mm-hmm. I think she was then out of her depth with the reference to the C-peptides. She actually, I won't say admit, she, what's the word I'm looking for? She acknowledged that the insulin episodes couldn't have happened naturally. That moment was one of those moments where I thought, she's already admitting that something exogenous, as it's called, has affected these babies. And then she qualified it by saying, yes, I agree, but it wasn't me.
That was a key moment, Mary, for you as well, the insulin, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. That was what really got me on the train and coming into court, which up to that point I had no intentions of doing. I've never been to court, never seen the need to go to court. But that was when I realised that so much more detail was being discussed and being explored in court than I was aware of. Mm-hmm. I felt I really needed to understand as much as I could because I didn't want it to be a nurse, you know, anything but. But unfortunately, as I said, after about 3 days, I was very much and reluctantly becoming persuaded that it was starting to look as though it couldn't be anybody else.
I said at the start that I'd developed opinions already from following the case online prior to attending court. Those views were that Lucy Letby was guilty, primarily due to the lie that she told about knowing what an embolism was, but thinking that it only occurred in adults. That was just not credible. That sort of like solidified it for me that she was guilty. I found her to be deeply, deeply dishonest in some of the answers she gave. Well, in most of the answers she gave.
Go Commando was the one for
Go
me.
Commando.
I don't know what Go Commando is.
Yeah, that was.
I do know, but I didn't at the time.
Well, bless you, Mary.
I'm still proud of myself for not bursting out laughing during that particular exchange between her and Nick Johnson. It was just so, so ridiculous. And then the final day of a cross-examination, that Friday, was particularly damning, I thought, in terms of just ripping apart a whole tissue of lies around being isolated from colleagues, not being allowed to socialise with them.
Mm. Which actually turned out to not be true.
Not
they
true.
Were
true.
All
that,
going
that
out.
Social
yeah,
life
she was
dossier.
Going
that,
out.
That social life dossier, even just down to silly, silly things around, oh, I was taken out of the house in my pyjamas. It was actually
a
Lee Cooper leisure suit, as Nick Johnson called it, a tracksuit.
Yeah. Well, we saw that, didn't we,
yes.
on the
yeah.
arrest
yes.
video.
Yeah, yeah. So from listening to her in court.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
But I just found it to be someone who's a compulsive liar.
One of the things that I found really a bit mind-blowing, actually, in the end, was just how calculating the whole thing was. Mm. You know, rewriting reports, timing things differently than they actually occurred. The text messages, as Ollie refers to, like setting things up. This baby's got sepsis. This baby's not looking well. It was so clever.
It was really clever, so clever that I thought it can't be true. You know, the prosecution have found this stuff. Have they really linked it together wrongly? But as it came out and it continued, it just became clear that, unfortunately, that seems to be the case, that she had planned these things.
When they found all the material was taking home handover sheets and the massive amount of paperwork, confidential stuff that she shouldn't have had at home at all, and her diaries with coded messages, her looking up families. It became a second occupation for her, didn't it? Almost like another job, because she'd nothing much else in her life.
Her life was that unit, wasn't it?
It fed her need to be needed and to be in control and to relish the situations and the collapses.
So you think that she enjoyed the kind of drama of
yes.
it? And
oh,
do you
I'm
think
convinced.
She wanted to be seen as almost a hero and save
I'm
some of
them? I'm convinced, yes. I'm convinced. I really don't know. I'm not a psychologist, but there is such a thing as the code blue junkie. It's a term given to people in emergency situations who revel in an emergency atmosphere. They're highly skilled themselves. They want to be the ones that are seen to be doing the resuscitation so well, whatever level of practitioner they are. And they revel in the attention of almost bringing these people back
to life
from the brink of death.
Ultimately, it's power, that, isn't it?
Yes, it's playing God.
That's actually what David Wilson said in our Vanilla Killer episode.
That's right.
That she had a hero complex and, you know, wanted to be at the centre of things.
Yeah. Yes.
It's interesting, these discussions around potential motivations and motivating factors. One of the things that I've sort of come to believe regarding Lucy Letby is that she has actually enjoyed inflicting that trauma on the families, inflicting that grieving. Mm.
She was almost enjoying being the hero for these parents, who was the one that could help them in their grief in that final moment. She was the one who wanted to do the bathing for them and reminisce about the first bath. And it was almost, it was quite disturbing.
She couldn't stay away from it, could she? She was told to come out of the rooms. But she kept returning to the rooms. It was as though she was just drawn to it and couldn't leave it alone. I'm struck by how much power she was exercising on the ward. She was exercising power in subtle ways. She was putting out crash calls, as we've already discussed, ensuring that the person that she wanted to come to respond to the crash came. She's creating bedlam, really, at times. She was working overtime, so she was hardly ever away from the place. And she was keeping tabs on colleagues, even when she wasn't on duty. And even, disturbingly, it seems, she was going in to the unit at night when she shouldn't have been.
That's the bit that got me.
Which was very disturbing, even more disturbing. There wasn't much door data evidence about that.
Data.
So somewhere policies have been fudged there.
She claimed that it was to update nursing charts,
So late at night, and I couldn't quite grasp that.
And she volunteered for shifts.
All the time.
Why was her next line manager not saying, I'm sorry, but, you know, you need to be off duty and get some sleep, some rest, some whatever. Why does he allow it? Why does he allow her to do all these extra shifts? Not only that, why did they allow nurses with phones in the pockets all the time? I find that absolutely appalling. Poor leadership. That they were able, at a bedside, a cot side, I should say, they were able to text friends and give them updates.
Well, she claimed, didn't she, that it was, she would never do that at the cot side, but it was...
But
it
even so...
It was
even,
prolific, wasn't it? Everyone on the unit was doing
but
it.
But even so, Liz, you wouldn't even do that at the nurse's station. If you were at a nurse's station, it's usually to file your own reports and put things onto a computer that, you know, you're memorising and whatever.
So you're saying you would only really use your phone if you're on a break?
Definitely.
Really? Oh, okay.
Definitely, definitely. I can't understand how that was allowed to happen.
One of the horrifying things to me that has certainly come over during prosecution and the matching of data has been the sleight of hand that has gone on here.
Go on, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, a nurse should be with the patient or the person they're caring for as much as possible and as much as needed. Nobody will be surprised at a nurse's constancy by the side of a fragile baby. It wouldn't occur to you that anything abnormal was going on.
The evidence was it would take, you know, 5 millilitres of air in a baby's bloodstream to kill them. So the time that would take to inject would be seconds, I assume.
Yes, it would.
And to think that you could have been on duty at that time when that was happening would be, I can't speak for those nurses, but for me, I would be disturbed forever, probably.
If I can just ask just some final thoughts from you all around the impact, your lasting impression, how you now feel. I'll start with you, Ollie.
It still hasn't fully sunk in yet. What I've borne witness to at Manchester Crown Court over the last few months, and certainly my thoughts and my impressions are just thinking of the people that have been personally impacted by this. The families that have lost children, the families that are now having to care for children who have lifelong disabilities because of Lucy Letby's actions, the medical staff that will have been undoubtedly traumatised from Lucy Letby's actions and having to try to revive those children. And on my way here today, I was came past Manchester Crown Court, and there was no, obviously it was empty, there was no press or anything like that, and it just shows how sort of life will move on for those of us who've attended in person, but you can't help but think of the people for whom this will never go away. Life will never be the same again because of one woman's evil actions.
It's not something that you can just put down and walk away from. We still don't know any motive. It's impossible to figure the kind of character that has acted this whole scenario out.
The enormity of the whole situation, but also the jury. Yes, they've listened, they've given them 10 months of their lives, and they have dealt with everything with such diligence, resilience, and I really hope that they seek any help they need and that so they can heal from this process.
The overriding feeling for me is, of course, it's sympathy for the families and what they've been put through all these years, but also is an absolute respect for the men and women and the team that have brought all this to, well, it's not closed yet. What an absolutely fantastic job they've done. And also, we should be so grateful for the criminal justice system that we have. It is second to none.
Jules, Ollie, Jane and Mary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that's it for episode 62. We'll be back next week as usual. But before we go, we did just want to share that last night we attended a vigil at Chester Cathedral where candles were lit for the babies that Lucy Letby murdered.
It was an incredibly poignant service and we thought you'd like to hear it.
So I'm Mark, I'm the Bishop of Chester. I just think it's really important that we gather in a place like this at a time when people are despairing, where they don't know where to turn, where there's anger, confusion, grief, all the things we were trying to capture in the service. Because actually the church exists to hold those kind of things when we don't know what else to do with them. And to just introduce some voice of hope. We're mourning the loss of children, of babies, in a most unjust way. But it was also really good to be together.
So I'm Tim Stratford. If you like titles, very Reverend Doctor, if you don't, ignore that. Cathedral Dean of Chester. The stories behind each of these children's deaths are immensely painful, aren't they? And, you know, at one level, we're used to hearing awful things and we can be immune. But here, we've entered into that pain and felt it and feel it. And I think, you know, living in Chester, this has happened in this community. I've asked myself, and in conversation with others, heard the same, how could this happen here? This has happened in the hospital that serves as a place that we know as a place of care. How could it happen here?
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget?
Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.